Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa celebrating a long-awaited ratings upgrade as fiscal discipline, it seems, pays off. Alcohol producers call for fair tax hikes to stop prices rising and to curb illegal trade. SMEs rally as South African exporters claw back ground after tough US tariffs. And South Africa heads for a 2026 travel boom powered by AI luxury and a new consumer passion. It's Monday, the 17th of November. Business Leadership South Africa says the country's public debt pathway is now turning a corner. The business body says that while the growth outlook does remain weak, the combination of fiscal discipline and improved revenue collection, as well as lower interest costs, are sending a positive signal to markets and investors. Well, let's talk now to Busisiwe Mavuso to explore what this means for the economy, for business, and our broader growth outlook. Busisiwe, welcome to you. So first of all, good news from S&P on Friday. Do you believe, though, that all ratings agencies and investors are now convinced by our fiscal story just yet?
I do, Jeremy. Good afternoon. And remember, Moody's has always been the one that has been quite lenient, I think, on South Africa. So I think Moody's was not our huge concern. The work that we did as the business community was mainly to engage with S&P and Fitch to try and highlight the progress that we've made as a country on the issues of fiscal discipline, on the issues of the reforms in particular, and the contribution of business to it. And we actually put together projections which showed what these reforms or how these reforms would actually impact the economy. So we are glad that actually the credit rating agencies are seeing this from our lens, and they can actually see how well the South African economy, you know, not just from an operations perspective, but I really think that from a strengthening perspective, you know, how they will how the reforms will benefit the economy going forward.
And against a backdrop of the perpetual issue of corruption and infrastructural deficiency, how difficult a case has that been to make for organized business?
You know, as much as there's been that deterioration, but there is work that is actually underway, Jeremy, which shows what we are doing to actually arrest the decay, the business involvement in as far as that is concerned. I mean, if you look at the issue of municipal reforms, for instance, you know, communicating what these reforms are going to entail, how we are going to be ring-fencing the water revenue, the electricity revenue, to ensure that we start to deal with the maintenance and infrastructure that is required, that is required, you know, on that infrastructural front. The fact that those municipal reforms are actually going to be suggesting that National Treasury be allowed to actually withhold the equitable share if they think that the municipality is not utilizing the money, you know, for its intended use. So that can actually now be given to National Treasury to do. I think the finance minister spoke to that last week as well at the medium-term budget speech. How the National Treasury can now intervene when they think that the municipal leadership is not of the right stature to can actually take the municipality forward. And that starts to talk or to give a rise to this professionalization of the public service that we've been talking about for quite some time. So all these are credible reforms. You cannot argue with the impact that they're actually going to have on the ground. And I really think that, you know, the credit rating agencies have actually seen that.
The difficulty, of course, is to balance the fiscal discipline that you referred to with growth and social needs. That, I would suggest to you, still remains a weak point.
It does, but I think what the credit rating upgrade also communicates, Jeremy, is that we are regaining control of the nation's finances. It says we are turning the trajectory towards sustainable growth, supporting fiscal management. You know, it shows that there is fiscal discipline. I really think that the issue of economic growth is going to be a lag indicator. I really think that we cannot also as a country be naive and underestimate the damage that we did to our economy over the last 10, 15 years. You know how many of these institutions have actually been weakened. And remember, institutional strength has been one of the key issues that we've always scored high on as a country. So if you now start to mess with those core institutions, you cannot not expect for there to be such repercussions. But I think the rebuilding work that is actually underway shows that South Africa actually will regain its former glory. And when you look at us, you know, in relation to our other sister African countries, there is no country that has got the same economic strength as South Africa, that is as strong, as resilient, and has such active private sector participation, that is most diversified, that has the most technological advancement, that has got better integration into the global economy. You know, we are one of the largest investors in Africa through our comparative advanced retail, telecoms, and financial services sector. So all of these things, I think, looked at, you know, together, really put across a very strong case. And our deep and liquid capital markets, all of these put across a very strong case, you know, for South Africa.
How important do you think this improved fiscal picture is then for South Africa's credibility as the G20 host, given that we are now moving into this important week?
It's quite important, because remember, we've been saying as a country that we want to show South Africa, we want to communicate to the world leaders that South Africa is a country on the mend. We want to communicate that South Africa is open for business. We want to communicate that South Africa is a market worth investing in. We want to communicate that South Africa is a jurisdiction that matters. So to have these independent international bodies, you know, really confirm, because FATF removing us from the grey listing communicates precisely that, you know, Jeremy. It says we have done the work to strengthen our anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing frameworks. It says we now have a financial system that is appropriately vigilant about abuse. You know, so these are not just bureaucratic achievements. They matter for our ability to attract investment and participate fully in global financial markets. You know, obviously the S&P upgrade as well communicates the same. You know, our budget is not something that we actually should undermine in terms of what it communicates. You know, our ability to reduce, you know, the public debt, to reduce the interest that we're actually paying, having stayed on fiscal discipline, you know, and that having paid off, reducing the debt service cost, you know, the primary budget surplus. And when you look at all the other countries, you know, which are in the same cluster of emerging economies and developing economies, South Africa in that cluster is actually the only country that is now having a budget surplus, for three times, you know, in a row. That speaks volumes. So all of that has counted in our favor.
So just a final one, and quickly, given apart from the United States that we have this coterie of world leaders all in one place, what's the singular message you think we should be landing at the G20 to reinforce this confidence in our economic direction?
South Africa is open for business. I really think that we need to communicate the progress that we have made, and we've got very strong proof points, you know, that have actually been confirmed by these external international agencies, Jeremy. If we get one thing out of this G20 hosting, it should be getting foreign direct investment into the country, because the one number that is more important in the country than any other number is 15%, and that is the gross fixed capital formation. We need to increase our gross fixed capital formation, and that will only increase as a result of business confidence. So our ability, therefore, to test whether this has been successful or not would be the growth of that gross fixed capital formation, because it shows that the world buys the story that we're selling. Right. It shows that they share in our confidence of the improvements that we've actually made as a country. And it is only through, you know, the growth, you know, in gross capital formation that will enable us to arrest our Achilles heel, which is the high levels of unemployment, poverty and inequality in this country.
Thank you very much indeed. From Business Leadership South Africa, Busisiwe Mavuso, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Beer Association of South Africa says that mini-budget must now translate into predictability for the alcohol industry. Chief Executive Officer Charlene Lowe has welcomed Treasury's push to narrow the gap between legal and illicit alcohol, warning that South Africa is losing something in the region of 16 billion rand in tax revenue due to illegal booze. But the organization is also calling for excise increases to stay in line with inflation, no more than 3.7%, to protect jobs, investment and the taxed beer industry. Charlene joins me on the program now. Charlene, welcome to you. Treasury talks about protecting the legal economy, but does the association really trust government to clamp down on illicit alcohol this time? It really is a problem in this country.
Thank you for having me. Absolutely. Illicit alcohol is a significant problem for South Africa. A recent Euromonitor study has shown that in 2024 alone, this is an industry essentially that is 18% of the alcohol market. It has lost government 16.5 billion rands in tax revenue, as you've highlighted in your introduction. And it is a growing industry, and it is beginning to compete with legal alcohol. And so we, in fact, do welcome all the efforts that have been announced by Treasury around clamping down on illicit alcohol, because it does threaten the tax base, but also it threatens people's lives and causes death, essentially, illicit and illegal alcohol.
We've heard this illegal alcohol term being bandied around for such a long time, but has your organization actually shown SARS where the revenue is being lost and how to recover it?
Oh, absolutely. We have had very constructive discussions with National Treasury around what it is that can be done. And so we've seen a real shift toward collaboration with government, where, you know, ourselves as an industry, we sit on several task teams that are made up of SAPs, of the DTIC, you know, where data and insights are being shared, and the focus being on supporting track and trace technology, stronger customs enforcement to detect imports and counterfeit products. So there are means and ways in which, you know, illicit alcohol can be deterred and or stopped. And there's more money, of course, that we know Treasury has in fact pumped into SARS to begin to enhance that enforcement. So we certainly welcome that. We certainly are part of the solution as well as an industry, and up for collaborating and working even more strongly and more, shall I say, more focused and purposefully towards making sure that we curb illicit alcohol.
And those are very noble sentiments, but given South Africa's enforcement weaknesses, what concrete actions would you expect SARS to take that will actually make a measurable dent in the illicit market?
For us, really, it is that enforcement needs to be solidified and made stronger. But I do believe also it does require that excise tax is looked at slightly differently. We do believe, of course, there's an absolute need for taxation. However, overtaxation is what ultimately drives the illicit market, where a consumer is forced to basically purchase illicit alcohol because illegal alcohol is no longer affordable to them. And so while we appreciate that it may be that higher excise taxes may be a way in which and a mechanism in which government may want to reduce consumption, we know that that doesn't necessarily happen. But instead, excise taxes, what it has done is push a consumer into the illegal market. And so as a tax instrument, it really is one of those things that is driving the illicit market, is driving illicit consumption and production. So for us, that is another area that I think government ought to look at as one of those levers it can utilize to reduce the illegal market, to reduce the tax revenue loss within that particular space.
Not the first time that your organization and others have raised this particular issue as far as excise taxes are concerned. Do you feel that you're actually being listened to, given that SynTaxes, as they're known, are a simple one to gather. Don't you feel that you're just banging your head against a wall sometimes?
It has indeed felt that way for many, many years, but we have seen some positive strides by National Treasury. Late last year in November, they published a policy document and a policy review document on excise. That for us is a positive move, if you will. We've recently come out of a public consultation process with them, where we are now into the technical conversation around that policy review paper with industry. And so we're seeing indeed greater collaboration, a greater appreciation for where the industry is coming from. And we're looking forward to more engagement. It is a far-reaching policy document. And so, you know, we've seen the first of what we believe will be many interactions with National Treasury around that particular policy review document. And we're hoping in the end we get heard and we have a fair and balanced excise policy document in the end. But we're well on our way to achieving that and attaining that. And we're doing that, you know, fortunately in this instance, in collaboration and in partnership with National Treasury.
How does the association respond to this argument that government finances, as we well know, are stretched? Why should beer duties not rise faster to fund social priorities?
Well, what we are seeing is that we are already a significant contributor to the country's GDP. I mean, the beer sector contributes over 96 billion to the economy. It supports over 210,000 jobs across farming, logistics, packaging, and retail. When excise increases are unpredictable or exceed inflation, businesses, you know, simply can't plan. It constrains investment, cuts into margins, but ultimately puts jobs at risk. And so for us, what we believe is that keeping excise increases in line with inflation protects these livelihoods, you know, and ensures in the same breath that the state continues to receive that steady revenue from the legal and taxed market. So that is really the position, I suppose, that we take around that.
And just finally then, if excise rises above your preferred 3.7%, have you quantified what the actual impact is going to be? Would it be higher prices, reduced production, job losses? Can you be specific?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we already have an industry that is battling, if you will, under the strain of, you know, inflation pressures, and as well as consumers, of course. So it doesn't affect only the industry. You know, high interest rates, consumer borrowing costs that remain high, production costs from an electricity and water perspective that continue to rise above inflation. The reality of the matter is the cumulative effect of this is that in 2024, or over the last 24 months, in fact, as a result, we've seen a depressed alcohol volume growth because of all these factors, inclusive of excise. And so if, as I indicated before, you know, ours is to, you know, keep these livelihoods going, ensuring, of course, that we maintain and sustain these 210,000 jobs. That is our objective as an industry. And so where the pressure continues to mount, this becomes quite difficult, you know, when one looks at it cumulatively with every other pressure that the industry is facing, quite apart from excise itself.
Charlene Lowe is the Chief Executive Officer of the Beer Association of South Africa. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I read that South African SMEs exporting to the United States have staged a modest rebound after what was a brutal September. There's new data from the SME Export Index. It's released by the shipping platform Tunnel that shows a 23% jump in October exports to the United States after a 52% collapse the previous month. But obviously, the sector is far from recovered. Shipments remain 40% below levels seen before President Trump's tariffs were announced in April, if I recall. Well, let's explore this in a little more detail. Aretha Cooper is with us, Chief Operating Officer at Tunnel. Let's discuss what the numbers mean and perhaps what might lie ahead in 2026 for small exporters. So, Aretha, welcome to. So that rebound in October, but exports still 40% below April. What has driven the limited recovery then?
So, Jeremy, I think what's important to note before I answer that question is just what we would normally expect to see at this time of year. So, as we've said, we often see a dip in September because That's just before the peak season. We see that. And that's kind of aligned with what we've seen, even though it's been much lower. But normally in October, we're starting to see our levels at around 120, 130% of what we'd see in April. Sorry, 20 or 30% above what we'd see in April. So we normally wouldn't expect to see an increase. And here we're seeing a 40% decrease. So it's pretty massive. That 23%, while we are seeing some improvements, it's pretty slim. We can talk about what's driving that. I think when the Trump tariffs were first announced, businesses really struggled. A lot of people just stopped shipping. They didn't really know how to respond. Everything happened really quickly. And that speed is what has hurt South Africa so hard. You know, suddenly the de minimis was removed. The Trump tariffs came in full effect. Everyone was loaded with a 30 to 40% tariff. And so people just didn't know how to react. And so people scrambled. And now I think we're starting to see their strategies come into play and actually accounting for that improvement that we're starting to see, even though it's very slim.
So new strategies, which is probably a good thing, but I wonder if SMEs then are adapting quick enough to this new tariff environment, or do you think the learning curve is going to remain steep for some time and they're just going to have to deal with the unpredictability?
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, I think the merchants that make up part of this data cohort are really are, you know, the small businesses. It's like one person business to businesses with 100 people. And they're really able to pivot fast, but it still just takes time. And I think a lot of this is driven actually from the US consumer side. I think the realization that this is a massive paradigm shift for US consumers. Everyone in South Africa who's purchased something overseas has had that SMS or that phone call saying, hey, you owe whatever, 400 Rand for duties and taxes. US consumers have never had that. So for them, it's the first time that they're ever suddenly faced with duties and tariffs. And they just don't know how to handle it. And so even though the South African merchants are adapting, we also need time for US consumers to kind of figure it out and realize this is their new world. They didn't realize they were actual global shippers, global purchasers, buying globally. And that's really hit them full frontal now.
I want to look at category in just a moment, but how serious is the risk to jobs when I think every percentage point that moves lower would represent surely thousands of livelihoods?
Yeah, I mean, this is massive, Jeremy. I mean, you know, every percentage point of gross merchant value that we're not exporting out of South Africa is money that isn't flowing back into our economy. It's jobs, it's production, it's everything. I think the reality is pretty dire out there for these small businesses.
Apparel and cosmetics, Aretha, I think if I read this correctly, have fallen by as much as 80%. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. Why have these categories been hit so much harder, do you think?
So I think these are categories where it's sort of discretionary spend, especially fashion. It's like you don't have to buy another pair of jeans. And suddenly, if you're faced with a product that's more expensive, you just abandon your cart. And so US consumers are, I think, somewhat overwhelmed. Suddenly, everything they were normally buying is actually more expensive. They don't know what's locally made, what's not. And so they're just cutting where, you know, while they wait for the dust to settle as well, they're just cutting the products that they don't need. So I think, as you say, apparel was hit almost 80%, beauty and skincare also 80%. One sector that we haven't seen a big decrease in is home and decor. So that only dropped about 17%. And there we could speculate on the reasons. I was trying to think about it this morning. And, you know, it may be that they're interior designers who are used to having certain homeware items that they feel, you know, people are investing in their home. And so they're going to pay a premium for an item like that that's going to, you know, sit on their shelves for ages versus a pair of jeans.
Interesting to see books and art remain stable. Am I correct in saying those would be tariff exempt, though?
Yes. So that's where you really see that it is the tariffs that is driving this. So those are, they're stable. Some of our customers ship to universities in the US, and there they need books, and they get a waiver. They're duty and tax free, so they don't pay the 30% reciprocal tariff, and then they are exempt from a product tariff. So they're traveling at 0% duties and taxes. And you can see that they've maintained throughout this period.
So are there lessons then from that sector that are tariff exempt that other categories could learn, or is it just impossible to draw a comparison?
No, there is some comparison. So the one thing that we've realized is because we had this very favorable de minimis of $800, so everything traveling under $800 traveled with zero duties and taxes. In a way that meant people were less careful about the duties and the tariff classification that they chose. So when you classify your product, you have to be very specific about what it is. And they all traveled at 0% if you were under $800. So people didn't think about it as much. But now they really need to go in there and make sure that they're using the most accurate and the correct tariff, the duty classification, otherwise, and can save them maybe up to 2 to 10% on duties.
And just finally, I'm assuming as we go into Q4, small exporters are going to be even more vulnerable given the kind of mix of holiday demand and the peaks and troughs that always exist around this time.
So we're really hoping that our merchants are going to have a good Q4. So generally, we see quite a big peak. You know, the sales happen around the end of November. They're shipping into December. They're getting goods out. But we definitely, Q1 is quite a quiet. We generally return to pre-Q4 levels. And so, you know, they may have a good November, December, but then January and February could be quite bleak.
And just a final one, have you applied your mind to what kind of support, either regulatory, logistical, or even financial, would make the quickest difference to SMEs who, as we've discussed, are still trying to survive this tariff shock?
Yeah, I mean, the government is moving. It's trying to do things. They support desks and funds, and that's all positive signal, but it's not moving the needle. I think what we really, really need here, the single biggest thing that we could negotiate is a reduction in those 30% reciprocal tariffs. So I think it's important to note that other countries are sitting at around 10 to 20%. So South Africa is sitting in a small group of countries that face some of the steepest penalties. And this is for a market that has historically been our biggest growth market. And so getting a chance to, so it also means that makes us uncompetitive when we compare to our peer countries. So this is the place where the South African government needs to get on board and help us negotiate better rates.
Thank you very much indeed, Aretha Cooper, Chief Operating Officer at Tunnel. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you're going to like this one. A new global study from Marriott Bonvoy shows South Africans are gearing up for a big year of travel next year, traveling more often, traveling smarter, and also using artificial intelligence to plan their holidays. Nearly 7 in 10 say they'll take the same number or more trips next year, with younger travelers leading the charge. The research also highlights two major trends shaping how we travel, something called luxscaping, where people, I understand, add a touch of five-star luxury to the start or the end of a trip. Also, passion pursuits, where holidays revolve around music, sport or adventure, and sustainability, loyalty programs and value for money, also standing out strongly. So this is all very interesting. Let's talk to Dorcas Dlamini Mbele from Marriott International to discuss some of these trends. Dorcas, welcome. Nearly 7 in 10 South Africans say they plan to travel more. Is this optimism, or does it reflect, you think, real disposable income in what we know is still a cost of living crunch?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on your show. Really such a pleasure to be able to share some of the insights from this study. But yeah, no, it just shows how, you know, the strong intentions that South Africans actually have behind traveling into the new year. I think, you know, the travel industry's resilience and adaptability, as well as coupled with the enthusiasm of South Africans, paints a really promising picture for 2026 and beyond. And what's more exciting out of the study is that it's the young people leading the charge in this instance. So we are really super excited about it.
So young people, in other words, Gen Z, driving that demand. But I guess I've got to ask you whether hotels, if they're going to stay there, are actually ready for a generation that has completely different set of expectations. AI-powered planning, personalized experience, sustainability. I suspect there might be a disconnect.
There might be a disconnect, but I think many of the hotels, including like ours from a Marriott perspective, you know, we are continuing to explore the opportunities within AI and what does that actually present for us to be able to deliver personalized guest experiences for this young generation. And that is also the reason why we do research like this, to enable us to understand how can we create experiences that will leave lasting impressions and also be relevant to the youngsters today. Some of the examples that came out of the study was the use of AI. Now, if you know, hotels and travel providers are not utilizing AI to be able to, or invest in AI in order for us to be able to be relevant to the young generation, we are just going to be left behind.
That is so interesting, because 59% of your respondents say they would trust artificial intelligence to book accommodation. Obviously, this is going to, over time, disrupt traditional travel agents and, Dorcas, even hotel call centers.
Well, everybody in the travel industry is going to be required to evolve with the time, right? I think it is important that we continue to use technology, whether it's a hotel or whether it's a travel agency or whether it's online travel agencies. We need to be able to use AI and technology to be able to position ourselves to offer the service, because I think, you know, one of the things about travel is that the person who delivers the travel and the human intervention is still going to be required, even if we are using technology.
Let's talk about this trend that I referenced at the start of our conversation called luxscaping. It really does sound glamorous, but is it a trend or simply wealthier travelers stretching one night of luxury into a marketing moment?
Well, what was really interesting out of this one as well is that it is the young generation leading the charge. We've got about 74% of the Gen Zs actually leading the charge in luxscaping, as well as 67% being the millennials. And essentially what these young South Africans are looking for here is an opportunity for them to elevate their trip, where they start off with something that is a little bit of a luxury in the beginning of their stay, or in off with maybe a spa retreat one night in a five-star hotel to allow them to have a little bit of a pamper and to kind of leaving them refreshed after their holiday. Again, what this really shows is how South Africans are really mindful and intentional in terms of how they are stretching their rands and getting the best value out of the trip that they would have been using.
Interesting that sustainability ranks high for South Africans, but I'm wondering whether the industry is really matching that expectation, or do you think that many travelers are just being sold green messaging without any real change?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think it's great to actually see out of this survey that South Africans, compared to other markets, actually are leading the charge. And, you know, ahead, we did the survey across 11 countries across Europe, Middle East and Africa, and South Africa came out tops at 76%. Now, sustainability for travelers is no longer just a simply nice to have or a buzzword, but it is a key consideration. And, you know, many of these young generation are actually making sure that we have proof points at our hotels, you know, showcasing exactly how we are, you know, we are evolving and impacting the environment in a positive way. Hotels in South Africa have implemented various ways to divert food waste from landfills. Some of the examples are composting programs like Bokashi composting, and as well as diverting food waste to agricultural sector for pig farming, for example. So there are real examples, and some of our hotels, for example, have been certified as green certified hotels, which is a long-term goal for us, but that continues to be work that everyone in the industry needs to put in.
And just a final one on risk. Country hopping, your survey says, is rising. That makes sense to me, but it obviously presents a challenge to hotels in South Africa if more travelers are splitting their spend across more destinations.
Well, I think it just it's not necessarily just maybe about splitting their spend, but it is allowing their guests to ultimately have multiple experiences, right, and diversifying their experiences. And what we found also out of the survey is that South Africans, whilst they are keen to travel South Africa as a top destination, but they are looking to have, you know, at least about six trips during the year two of those probably just domestic,
Mm.
and then probably two of those being regional in some parts of our beautiful continent in Africa, as well as long haul travel. So I think there is always an opportunity for travelers to be able to country hop or market hop or city hop. And I think South Africans being so intentional about their experience, they are willing to spend a little bit more time in different places.
Well, I'm looking forward to doing a little bit of luxscaping in December. Dorcas Dlamini Mbele, thank you very much indeed from Marriott International. Fascinating conversation. Appreciate your time. But before I do that, let me just remind you that you've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.